Hi, this is Jerry Agar. You're listening to the podcast for Monday, April 24th. On the show, the panel discussed the myth regarding the rich versus poor. Would you sell a house without a real estate agent? And are we getting conflicting reports about concussions in the NHL?
That's the fact.
It's ridiculous.
Because it's common sense.
What's the learning curve on this?
Live free and easy lives.
Good morning, Jerry.
It's time to set the GTA straight. It's Jerry Agar's 908 Minute of Sanity.
Have you heard that the rich have all the money and the rest of society has nothing? Did you know that the top 20% of households in Canada hold 67% of the personal wealth and the bottom 20% hold no wealth at all? It seems unfair. Chris Sarlo is an associate professor of economics at Nipissing University in North Bay, Ontario. He had a great editorial in the Toronto Sun over the weekend explaining why that situation exists and why it always will and perhaps it should. So stay with me on this. Professor Sarlo points out it mostly has to do with age. He writes, imagine a perfectly egalitarian society where everyone is identical in every aspect except for age. Everyone would have exactly the same lifetime income and wealth. Isn't that what people who complain about inequality want? But naturally, people would have different levels of wealth at different stages of life. As a person gains experience on the job, they should be paid a higher wage, especially if they become managers, etc. So in such a society where everybody is the same, if everybody saved 10% of their income in a fund for retirement, then at any point in time, the top 20% would have 50% of the wealth and the bottom 20% wouldn't have any. How much difference does the factor of age and experience factor into wealth inequality? Professor Sarlo says in a study he did, he found that age accounts for about 80% of wealth inequality in Canada. What about the other argument made by the inequality police? They say the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. The professor says, in fact, that's changing. It's been declining since the early 70s. The wealth gap, he says, is not growing, it's shrinking. So one more set of numbers to back this up. Stats Canada shows that in 2012, the average household net worth ranges from $55,800 for those under 25. This isn't the value of the house, it's the wealth that the people own. To, for those people between 40 and 44, $466,000. And for those people in their late 60s, almost $1 million. The lesson here is to stop listening to activists and politicians who pander to jealousy in order to champion restrictions on success. Look after your own house. Worry about you. On the panel today, Robert Turner, who is the host of the early edition at 5 in the morning, except for tomorrow when he apparently refuses to come in, and I'll do it.
I have a good reason, Jerry.
Okay, what is it?
My dog is having surgery today, so I need
to
take care of her.
At 5 in the morning?
No, but it's going to be a rough night, I figure. So
oh, yes,
I
got to
deal with her overnight. Yeah.
Worse than a baby, huh?
Yep.
All right. John Burnside, city councilor for Ward 26, former police officer. That'll play into one of our stories. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Becky Coles, producer extraordinaire for The Morning Show.
Hi, Jerry.
Was that a good intro?
I like that.
Okay, fine. I'll see you dark and early tomorrow. All right. Does anybody have anything they would like to add to what I said about wealth inequality?
You're way older than me. Can I have some money?
Not if I have to come in and work for you.
All right. Well, I'm just saying.
Well, that's the end of that.
Based on what you said, you got all the money because you're old.
I understood that as Jerry sharing with everybody.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, I agree with Jerry completely. First of all, in Canada, it seems like we don't celebrate success. It's almost like it's a bad thing. But it reminds me about 20 years ago, and I was actually talking to my dad about this, and they always talk about the income inequality in gender. But if you actually dig down and look at statistics, university-educated women, single university-educated women make more than single university-educated men. And this is the same sort of idea in that you read a headline, you see a headline enough, you believe it, and no one actually takes the time to do the research to understand what the issue is and how the facts play out.
Want to stand up for the sisterhood on that one, Becky, or do you think he's right?
I think he definitely has a point, but I think it's... I don't know. I think it's really easy to say that to people, but when they feel like they're struggling and they feel like that they're...
Yeah, but everybody feels like they're struggling and everybody feels like they're middle class. And then when somebody comes along and says, we'll tax the rich and not the middle class, they don't realize that
a lot of people that I know that think that they're middle class lower class. And it's like, no, actually, you're middle class. Sorry. That's not how this works. That's part of the problem. Nobody knows where they are in the structure unless you're absolutely making nothing or you're doing very well. There's a lot of people in between that don't know where they fit.
I also think that people have always thought the generation coming up, act like they're more entitled and they aren't like we were. And every generation coming up thinks they're the first one that's had to deal with any adversity and that everybody else ahead of them had it really good. I mean, all of the millennials we talk about that are going to have, they're having the challenges we talk about it like it's this is the first generation that's had an issue affording housing in the GTA. Talk to people when mortgage rates were through the roof in the 80s. A lot of people dealt with that. Different reasons, but the same kind of thing. Student debt, people have had that before. This is not entirely new. The one thing that has changed, and I think everybody in their 20s has to remember this, is you're going to live a lot longer. So, oh, it's taking us longer to start. Yeah, but you're going to be where you are for a lot longer.
Well, I think that the people at the other end of the equation have to think about that as well, because many years ago, if we go back enough years, first of all, I might be dead. Second of all, if I wasn't, I'd be a few years away from retiring, getting a gold watch, and then dying. A
couple years later, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So maybe we need to rethink retirement, because while it is true that as you get older, you gain more wealth, as we were just discussing, unless you've made a lot of mistakes, or in some cases, tragic mistakes, things happen to people. Unless you've done that, then maybe we need to look at we work till 70 or whatever.
I think we definitely are going to have to, because the system just won't be able to support all the people that are living till 90 and 95 and the increasing number of them. The one concern.
Well, we're going to look after that with assisted death.
Well,
there's Jerry, glass half full.
some Monday morning cheer. But the one concern I do have is that in days gone by, it seemed to be a lot easier for people to get into the middle class without an education. You could go and work at GM. You could work at Nabisco. You mm-hmm. could work at the Lever Brothers. Now, especially in small towns, what do you do? Well, you work at Tim Hortons.
Yeah, like when you were in Listowel, you would go work at the Campbell's plant. Well, now they're moving the Campbell's plant, or they're closing down and changing shifts or something else, right? And now it's, well, where do you have to go? Well, you might not get a job in Listowel unless you go to the Tim Hortons. That's a good point.
I know, but you used to be able to just make a living by staying on your father's farm and taking your father's farm over and growing mm-hmm. the beets and being able to make a living. Things change. Adapt to the world around you. On the panel today, we have Robert Turner, John Burnside, and Becky Coles. And hey, congratulations to us. Won a couple of awards, the station did. RTDNA, the Radio Television Digital News Directors Association. Is that right, Robert?
I think you added a D there at the end. I don't think there's a News Directors
Just
Association.
Just News Association?
Yeah, that's
okay.
The one, yep.
Won two awards. James Moore won the award for Best Short Feature, Uber v. Taxi Debate.
This is certainly not meant to be any disrespect to the hardworking taxi cab industry that is in this room.
It might be the only thing they can agree on.
That everyone show respect for each other and for this chamber.
I know you're trying to use my time up to ask more questions.
I wish you wouldn't attribute any motive.
If I have another outburst, I will be asking everyone to leave the council chambers.
Yeah, this debate is vintage City Hall.
That's why James wins awards.
He got a plaque for that. Does he have to go share that with Frances Nunziata? Because she did a lot to help there.
He should at least photocopy it and thank her. Send it over.
At least
and thank
go do
her.
A photo op.
Yeah, or take a really nice photo of it and put it in a frame and send it over. And meanwhile, the award for commentary went to Jim Richards of the Showgram here on News Talk 1010. And here's a little bit of what he had to say. The morning after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, there were 49 people killed that night.
49 people. If you're a parent, those first high school crises, 49 souls just beginning to find their voice as they grow up. 49 first heartbreaks, 49 children. Not statistics, not people's groups, not causes. Not cultural war symbols, not illustrations or examples or stereotypes or case studies. Children. Someone's children.
Good perspective from Jim. Not surprising, Robert, that he win an award for that.
No, not at all. And I mean, Jim has it all out there when he does his show.
Yep. Jim spends 98% of his time being a goofball, and then all of a sudden he does something like that. And every once in a while that happens, and you realize what a human being there is behind the jokes and the cynical look that he takes sometimes.
Well, I think we're all like that, right? Yeah. I think especially in this business, we all, we kind of become desensitized to a lot of things. And so we tell the stories and we complain and everything else. But then there's certain things that just hit you differently, right? And you relate to it in a different way. And I think that's what happens with Jim a lot.
All right. Congratulations to Jim and James Moore and the radio station on those awards. France's next first lady could be a grandmother of seven. Well, that's not surprising. She's 25 years older than her husband. She taught him at school when he was a teenager. When he was 17, he told her he was going to marry her. Now he might be the leader in France, and she'll be the first lady, and he's 25 years younger than her. But this is a good thing, Robert, because all politicians, you know, they listen to their spouse, their partner, so they don't have any choice. And as we all do, anybody who thinks family doesn't have impact on a politician is out of their minds. So she's got a lot of experience. She can give him wise advice.
Yeah. I get this. This is a headline story, but it's really only a headline story because the genders are flipped, right?
Well,
this
I
was
think
an old dude with a younger woman. Nobody would care.
No, I think that would still be a story, but not as much a story.
You're... Well, the whole high school part where she taught him, that is a little weird and, you know, creepy, possibly unethical. But yeah, I'm not. Sometimes people are different. Is it a real relationship, right? Only they know that.
Yeah, only they don't know. Yep.
Well, but hold on. The only reason it's flipped is because guys just generally don't do that. Right, it's that's the bottom line. I'm not going to comment any more than that. Otherwise, I'm just going to get myself into trouble.
Come on, what do you want to say?
Well, I would say it seemed like a good
listening idea
when he was 17.
Listen, you're a Toronto city councilor. How much more trouble could you be in?
Whatever you say, well, man, the lady's going to say something stupider. So go ahead.
That's a good thing about council. The bar is so low.
Yeah.
But that's also the problem. Is that the bar is low, right?
Yeah, okay. No kidding.
And this is stupid. It's absolutely stupid. It's even more stupider.
Okay.
Mammaliti's the gift that keeps giving with that. But, you know, Jerry, it's interesting because we actually recently had a conversation about this, about age differences and everything else. And I don't have an issue with it. I really don't. I've never dated someone my age. They've always been older.
But you're young enough that 25 years younger than you is off the table.
Well, but I've never dated anyone younger than me.
Oh, never?
Never.
Would you consider it?
Possibly.
Maybe the older you get.
Well, that's just it. Things start to change, right? But for me, it's not an issue. And I get that it's a story because it's a world leader and everything else. But and I think Robert's right. It's because the roles are changed. If this was a man and a woman, it wouldn't be as big a deal.
Yeah. There was a great editorial in the Toronto Sun that I think articulated the position of many people when it comes to whether or not the city council, of which John Burnside is a member, should follow the request of the Toronto Police Association and defund the city's portion of the Gay Pride Parade. It is not. The Pride Parade is, nobody's asking that it be canceled. They're just saying, don't put the $260,000 gift in this year because they have disallowed the police. Councillor, how are you going to vote on that?
Well, I would at this point vote to defund it for a couple different reasons. To begin with, Pride can do whatever they like. They're a private organization. But the moment any organization comes to the city, then you have to play by our rules. We don't have to play by your rules. So that's the first thing. Secondly, Jerry and I, we were talking about this very briefly earlier. The analogy I would use is you have a neighbor. You didn't like each other, but you have this, after years of talking and seeing each other, you have this rapprochement, and your neighbor invites you to his first child's wedding. So you go and you get them a nice gift. And then for some reason, unbeknownst to you or out of left field, at least, now the neighbor says, it's my second child's wedding. Here's your invitation. But a month or two before the wedding, the neighbor calls up and says, actually, you're not invited anymore, but I still want the gift.
Yeah, I don't like you anymore, but I still want the gift.
Still want the gift. And my response is, no gift.
Okay. Then my next question is, how many councillors feel the same way as you and would actually put their hand up and vote? Because I have found councillors who will say one thing to me and then vote entirely the other way.
Well, Jerry, the good thing about you is you always hold me accountable, so you know that
Are councillors talking about this?
They are. It's really hard to get a read. What I would say is Councillor Campbell's leading the charge, and he's doing a very good job, and he's a very level-headed
leading
person.
The charge to defund?
To defund. You know, assuming the police, who are actually City of Toronto employees, by the way, don't get reinvited to the parade. It's very hard at this point because to what you say, Jerry, is most politicians privately, or many politicians privately, feel the way I do publicly, but a lot of them would just rather this go away.
Yeah, because and what they have that's my
right,
point.
And what I'm saying is, this is one of those issues where the rubber's going to hit the road.
With more of Toronto's breaking news, traffic, and weather, here's Jerry Agar, News Talk 1010.
On the panel today, Becky Coles is here, producer for The Morning Show and the award-winning producer of a PTSD documentary on this station. John Birdside, city councilor for Ward 26, former police officer, and Robert Turner, the host of The Early Edition at 5 a.m. when I'm not doing it.
It's one day, Jerry. One day.
Jerry,
we
you're
all appreciate
really
your help.
Like, talk about bitterness. Wow.
This intro is getting worse than almost Jim Warren's.
Just a second.
I mean, that's a pretty bad one.
All right. Who else wants to get up in time to do that show and come in here?
I'll do it.
Okay. We settled that.
I'm good.
He doesn't really care.
I'm not doing it.
As long as he's not coming in.
All right. I'll talk to you at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning. We'll just talk about Robert. Me and Russ Courtney. We'll sit around and talk about Robert for half an hour.
I'll be sure to listen.
Okay. A couple of things to talk to you guys about. Report, I guess the Metro News put this together. Students in Toronto's arts-focused high schools are overwhelmingly white and come from high-income families, despite living in one of the most diverse school districts in North America. This apparently is research from the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. Researchers found 67% of those students identified as white, compared to only 29% of the elementary school population in the city. Robert, is this a problem?
I don't know. I mean, is it a shock that people who we know statistically are probably going to do better because of all those demographic boxes go to a special school where, because this is not a school that's based on where you live, right? This is a school that you have to want to get into and sort of audition for.
And you have to get yourself there.
Yeah, two factors. You have to want to get in.
Right.
Then you have to audition to get in.
So I would expect that kids with more privilege, however we want to define that privilege, and whose parents, you know, have the time and resources to help them with that may more easily be able to get in. And maybe that's something we should look at. Maybe that we should look at, do we need to do more funding arts in schools in areas where maybe they don't have those advantages to try and give those kids a shot at it? Maybe that would be something to look at.
Well, so my impression of the arts world is that for most artists, they don't make a lot of pay. And so it's a tough road. So what I would, one of my thoughts is that, well, if you're coming from a wealthier family, you have that backstop. Whereas...
Yeah, but most of those kids don't go into the arts anyway. I think what they do is they go to that school, and some of them will then go on and study music or dance or theater or whatever in university. But great numbers of them, in fact, you find out that this kid who plays the cello so well is about to go to such and such a university to get into medicine or something else.
There are a few of them, but I still think in the area I represent, Mark Garneau has got this wonderful science mathematics program, and that's attracting tons of newer Canadians. I think they see that, you know, it's just my idea or impression.
They see that as more of an avenue to the future.
Right.
And are those schools then more predominantly immigrant than they are?
Oh, I think this one's probably about 95%. Absolutely.
Okay.
And it draws from around.
And is anybody going to come along with a report and say, oh my God, we need to get some of those immigrants out there so the white kids can take the science program?
Well, hang on. No, maybe they're going to look at it and go, what can we do to make sure that this is open and accessible to everybody? It doesn't have to be we have to take from one group to give to another.
Well, that's usually how
I don't think that's the way it works, though, Robert. I don't think that's the way it works. I think it's more about when the whites aren't, white people aren't necessarily represented, I don't think everyone cares as much. And I understand why they don't.
Okay,
I understand
then,
that.
Let me throw another wrench in the works then make Becky talk about it. And that is my anecdotal experience. I don't have a study, but I do have kids in art school. So my anecdotal study is the art schools are overrepresented with gay students. Does somebody want to do something about that, or is that just okay?
Well, that's my problem with surveys.
See, I think
like
it's okay,
this,
by the way.
Well, I just don't care.
Yeah,
like,
well,
whoever
yes.
wants to go there and audition and gets in, great. If you want to go to a science school, fantastic. If you have the marks and you get in there, that's good. And it's true, Jerry, what you said. I know a ton of people that went to Cawthra, which is an art school in Mississauga, that they went there because it was a good school and it was around the corner. And at the point when they were going there, you didn't have to audition quite the same. So they said it's great, but they weren't going into the arts, or maybe they were kind of musicians, but now they're not doing anything with it. But I think with all of this, it's every stereotype we've ever grown up with is just kind of living out numbers, because you can manipulate the numbers however you want. But I think for sure it's something to look at and say, oh, well, it's interesting that maybe there aren't certain demographics going into things. Well, how do we encourage them to go into it and make it easier?
Because we're paying for it, right? These are publicly funded schools.
No, that is exactly right.
So we need to make sure that these are being advertised in all the schools and that kids know it's an available option, and not just kids at the schools where there's more money.
Well, we figured it out on our own.
What?
They didn't have to advertise it to us. You know, you go online and look at what school and what education is available in Toronto, and you'll find out about those things.
Yeah, but one of the problems is there are so many parents that may not speak English.
Yeah.
So there is that barrier. I accept that. I just think that they're making a big deal out of this when they really don't know all the facts.
All right. So we'll stop manipulating numbers and start manipulating Yonge Street. Sue Ann Levy in the Toronto Sun today: is North York's quiet $51 million plan nothing more than a vanity project for some councillors who want to look good to their neighbors or their friends, I guess, at wine and cheese parties or something? What they want to do is replace two lanes of traffic on Yonge with bike lanes. This is from Shepherd North to Finch, one of the more congested areas of the city. Who's involved in this? Chief Planner Jennifer Kiesmatt, new Transportation General Manager Barbara Gray, who's a bicycle enthusiast from Seattle, where they've had to close down the public bicycle program because it's a failure, and Willowdale Councillor John Fillion, the offer of the Toronto Street Food Pilot Project that drove some entrepreneurs into bankruptcy. So, Councillor, what do you think?
Well, this is going to be quite the battle at council. The main protagonist in this is Councillor Shiner, who I think is probably the smartest guy on council and one of the most respected. And he represents the area just adjacent. I think this is a total nightmare. I'm not going to talk about Councillor Fillion per se or any other politician, but I think there's a lot of stuff going on in the city that are legacy projects. Rail Deck Park is another one.
Which
that comes
is another
to mind.
Way of saying vanity project.
Yeah. But yeah. I'm not saying this one in particular. I'm just saying as a general. The other problem I have is that part of Yonge Street was developed with the car in mind. It's not like Queen Street East or whatever, where they were built when people walked everywhere. So it's a totally different situation. The last point is that's one of the worst areas for congestion. The reason is everyone's coming off the 401. Well, this argument, well, more people will cycle. Well, they're not cycling on the 401. So you're not...
Yet.
Well, but my point is, you're going to have that congestion because of its proximity to the 401, and you can't take out lanes of traffic.
Okay, so then, therefore, this will happen.
No, well,
it's really stupid, so it'll happen.
It'll be interesting. Well, yeah. Well, of course, it's City Hall.
All
but
right.
It's interesting because, you know, Mayor Tory's caught in the middle on this one.
This debate is vintage City Hall.
John Burnside, Robert Turner, Becky Coles on the panel today. Ontario police forces share carding data with Mounties and CSIS. This is a Toronto Star report. A couple of their reporters worked this out. The province's counterterrorism plan, reviewed by the Star, directs local police forces to share intelligence gleaned from street checks with key partners, including Canada's spy agency, raising fresh concerns about the use of personal information. To me, and John Burnside, in addition to being an elected official, you were a police officer, there are two issues here. One is whether or not any police entity, whether it's the local police, CSIS, the RCMP, whoever it is, the OPP, has information legitimately is question number one. Question number two is, if they have it legitimately, why wouldn't they share it with everybody else? Aren't you supposed to?
No kidding. Could you imagine if an attack happened and it was revealed that the police actually, Toronto police stopped someone on a basis of whatever, had suspicions but couldn't share it with another level of government?
Well, that was supposed to be the lesson of 911.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, a lot of, they call
9/11,
them,
9/11 actually. They call
them street checks, which a lot are. But quite often those cards are handed in as a result of a call. So officer goes to a call, there's some suspicious behavior, no charges, they put a card in. So, you know, this is exactly how the system is supposed to work.
Okay, but Robert, what I'm trying to do here is separate having another...
Yeah,
you know,
I get what you're trying... Theoretically, it makes sense, but I also think we've been told that the data that Toronto Police has is sort of behind firewalls and they got to get special permission to look at it. And this makes it sound like it's available to other police forces if they want it. So that those two messages aren't the same.
Yeah.
I don't want police stopping anybody just because they want to collect information. That doesn't seem like something that should happen in a free country. If they have a legitimate reason to interact with somebody and document it, fine. If they don't, leave people alone. And that,
yeah. But that's why I said if they, we can argue about what information they should have, but if one police entity has, Becky, gathered information legitimately, I think it should be not only accessible, perhaps just handed to all the other police entities.
Yeah, I was surprised that people are confused about this. It's like you should be sharing information because when you don't, that's usually when we have a problem, right? So I'm not necessarily against collecting information. I'm a lot like Robert where it's like, well, it shouldn't just be Wild West just basically randomly stopping people. But if you have an interaction and there seems to be a reason for it, why aren't we collecting it and sharing it?
But and then you hear Nia Singh's story, though, where he actually got his carding data through Freedom of Information and they've got his ethnicity wrong. They have his height wrong. There's all kinds of wrong information.
No, but just that's a different issue. That's a totally different issue.
They said he was 8'1". That's close enough.
Yeah. No, seriously.
Was it a couple of feet?
Yeah. But that's the thing, right? I mean, so what value is this information?
But that's why it's two different questions.
But who do the police work for? Like, it seems to be we're getting conflicting messages on all this that, oh, well, the province is going to crack down on carding because this is an unfair practice. But you're kind of going to be able to keep doing it and share the data you've already got. Like, everybody seems to want to suck and blow at the same time on this. Either people have rights to when they're going to communicate with the police, and anyone should be able to. If the cops have data on me, I should have access to it. I should know what
but
the cops have on me.
That's a totally different. That's fine, but that's a totally different argument. The question here is: police stop someone for whatever reason, or gather information. We don't even know that they've stopped anyone. It could be you saying something that your neighbor's suspicious. They get that information. I think they have an obligation to pass it on to CSIS if it's something terrorist related.
Okay. All right. I have my suspicions as to whether or not, in fact, the electric car is our future. And so I'm attracted to a headline like this from the Associated Press. Electric cars come with range anxiety for rural drivers. I think the electric car works for people who live in a large metropolitan area. They don't have to drive very far for anything over the course of a 24-hour period. And then, of course, they can plug the thing in at night and they're good to go again tomorrow. But you live anywhere outside the GTA, let's say. Becky, I'm not sure this works. And we're a long, long way from it working.
No, and as soon as this all started to become more common, I've been trying to be more mindful of paying attention to where do I see charging stations in parking lots, right? So I noticed one a few weeks ago at Shops at Don Mills. Then I noticed one at Cloverdale Mall. And I go, okay, well, that's good. You can get from A to B and charge up if you need to and everything else. But I think for me, I'd be frightened, especially if I was living in the middle of nowhere. Like, where the heck am I going to charge up? Or what if there's a power issue? Because the power goes out more in rural areas. And so then you're thinking, well, how am I going to get to where I need to get to? Then you're going to have a generator and everything else, which, hey, that's fine. But it's just one more expense and one more thing. But it's funny that they're saying that, range anxiety. Well, I know a ton of people that have that anyway, because they've decided that they're going to be like Kramer on Seinfeld, and they're going to see how far they can go. And now now that your car tells you how much you potentially have, people are going, I'm going to get it down to one. And I go, no, I do not want to be in the car with you. I have to be somewhere. I don't have time for this, roulette game.
Well, I also worry, and maybe they'll overcome this, but John, what I worry about is, okay, fine, you've got it up to where in favorable conditions I can go 300 kilometers in this thing. But when I get to the en route or the wherever it is I stop, how long do I have to sit there waiting for it to charge up?
Or worse yet, let's say someone's ahead of you.
Well, yes, that's what I mean, like the whole total trip.
Yeah.
I could be there. Look, there's only so much Tim Hortons coffee I want before I want to get back on the road.
To your point, I don't think this, it's not going to be widely adopted unless they can get those batteries up to like 1,000 kilometers. And quite frankly, people in Toronto care about the environment. I'm going to get in trouble for this comment. I'm not sure that people in rural Ontario are as sensitive to carbon emissions.
I think they're also not as convinced that this makes a difference because that battery is its own carbon footprint. And not only does it have to be recharged with something that was generated in a different way, so we still have to generate power. When we start filling the landfill up with those batteries, then we've got another issue, Robert. And I know somebody will write to me and say, oh, well, Tesla recharges it. Not forever, they don't. Those batteries eventually have to be thrown away.
Sure. And I expect that technology will just get better and better and better. And probably, there was a time 100 years ago where people were talking about range anxiety because they weren't sure there was going to be a gas station and they could rely more on a horse. It's either going to be the new technology and it's where we're going to go. I don't care how my car is powered. I don't care if it is one of those unicorn slushies that I can dump in from Starbucks or gas or Christmas magic. If my car goes, I'm happy. If it doesn't, I have a problem.
Okay.
So this industry is going to have to demonstrate to everybody that range anxiety is not warranted.
But here's the problem. I don't care either. But the reason the gasoline engine beat out the electric car in the first place 100 years ago is because it's more efficient and gets us around better. I don't think they've really solved that problem. You and I might not care what kind of power the car uses. We just want to get from A to B. But politicians, as you know, John Burnside, care mightily and don't give a damn whether it makes sense.
Well, there's that, but if...
That's why we have a Green Energy Act in this province.
Absolutely, but if the provincial government keeps raising the tax on gas and makes it cost prohibitive, and you can drive around without paying any tax in an electric car, you'll see people moving.
You know, somebody just wrote in and said, people in the city can say all they want, that they care about the environment more than people in the country do. Well, if that's the case, stop driving out into the country to dump your old refrigerator into the in the ditch and leaving it in my nice country road. Thanks to all of you.
Toronto's breaking news, traffic and weather. This is Jerry Agar, News Talk 1010.
Come on down, get a house. You know how it looks like when you watch a TV crime drama? They can solve a crime in an hour. Well, you can sell a house in 15 minutes, apparently, according to reporting here on News Talk 1010. Our news department has taken up a series on real estate in this community. It's a hot issue. No matter where you go, who you talk to, it seems like real estate becomes a part of the conversation. So here on the radio, of course, that's no different. But quite an amazing story, I thought, as I was driving in this morning and first heard it on the early edition with Robert and Russ, and you heard it through the morning show, and that is that gentleman sold his house on Kijiji in 15 minutes. And he said he's had his lawnmower up for sale on Kijiji for a long time, and he couldn't sell it. His name is Joe, and here he is.
You give me $980, 50 grand cash, no conditions, and we got a done deal. And he said, okay. So literally from the time I listed it on Kijiji to the time I sold it, was about 15 minutes.
He's had the house for about 4 years. He did well.
You know, I bought it 4.5 years ago for $575, and I sold it for $980 in 4 years, and it's my principal residence, so it's tax-free.
So then the question becomes, what's the point of having a real estate agent? Now, you probably know this, but just to be very upfront, full disclosure, I do ads on this show for Frank Leo, and you hear me do recorded ads throughout the course of the day for Frank Leo for Emax West. So you can take what I have to say with a grain of salt when I tell you that I believe that, yes, you can easily sell in this market without an agent. You can sell with any agent, even one of those agents that doesn't know what they're doing. And believe me, there are plenty of them. That's why they only sell a house or two through the course of a year. Or you can just sell it yourself. I have often said, even in the paid ads for Frank Leo, could anybody sell a house in the GTA? Yes. Because it's a hot market. Can anybody sell a house and get top dollar? Well, we don't know. The value of having a number of people vie for your home is that when they compete with one another, you are more likely to have the maximum amount offered by somebody. In fact, I believe that if I sold my house on Kijiji and somebody showed up and wanted it in 15 minutes, I would tell them, give me a couple of days and get back to me. Is that your top offer? I'll let you know what the best offer I have is a couple of days from now. I mean, let's face it, ladies, you don't marry the first guy that comes up to you in a bar and makes some sort of proposal. That's not the best deal, okay? The best deal may have come in 15 minutes through Kijiji. There's no way now for me to know that. I guess there's no way for him to know that either. So what's your course of action if you are in the market at the moment? Would you prefer to sell on your own? One person who gave me a reasonable argument for selling on his own is my producer. Now, you in fact might put your condo on the market, George.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Should we give your phone number if somebody wants a condo?
Not yet.
Not yet. Maybe in 15 minutes we can sell your condo right here on the show.
We probably could.
Okay, But being in a condo building where you see units bought and sold, what, on a weekly basis?
Yeah, we have a realtor in the building.
Yes.
And every month I get a flyer saying, hey, these units sold for this, this, and this.
Okay, so you feel you actually know what your unit is worth.
Exactly.
Because let's face it, if I buy yours on the 12th, I don't know which floor you're on, doesn't matter. But if I buy yours on the 12th floor or the one that's for sale on the 9th floor, they're the same condo.
Exactly, especially
so in the same building, in the same neighborhood. There's no difference.
Exactly.
It's just you're on the elevator for 6 seconds longer, whatever. That's pretty much it.
Pretty much.
Right? So you know the value. But when you're selling a house, every single house is different. And it isn't just you could, in fact, have the exact same floor plan, same builder, but that house is on this street and house B is on that street, and that can make a difference. What's the traffic volume? What's the proximity to school? What's the proximity to a main road as opposed to the other one? There are so many considerations that go into it, it's difficult to know what your house is worth. 872-1010 is the number, and I'd be happy to hear from you if there is no way you would consider using an agent, and you know you can get the best price on your own. How will you do that? The number is a 416 number, 872-1010. Now, Joe, the guy who sold his house in 15 minutes off Kijiji, is happy. And it's his house, and he's happy. And I assume the buyer is happy. No problem. I don't care what you do. That's... I'm not trying to talk you into something or out of something. I don't care. I just don't think you should make the assumption that the real estate agent just gets a cut of what you could have sold the house for anyway. The number is 872-1010. The text number is 71010. And here's Nick.
Hey, Jerry. How are you doing this morning?
Doing well.
Good. I was just thinking about it. I know most real estate agents charge between 4% and 5%. So if you eliminate... You eliminated the real estate agents, you would basically have 40 or 50 grand if you're selling for $1 million.
Uh-huh.
Right? You got 40 or 50 grand in your pocket on top of that, you know, that you don't have to kick up to the real estate agent. So,
well, there's no question, Nick, but that's off the million. But what if the agent could get you 1.2?
Well, I guess you get into semantics then, right? I mean,
well, it's not semantics. I mean, if you
it's 150 grand, right?
Yeah.
A lot. Right? That is a lot. I guess it depends on how long you want to do it, the convenience level. I know some people, they just don't want to even bother having people come and look at their houses because they have to, like, get them ready. They have to leave all the time, especially if you have young kids. It comes really inconvenient for these middle-of-the-week showings. And stuff
all right,
like that.
But this guy who sold off Kijiji, he had the guy come through the house.
No, I know. He did great. I think he's on to something for sure.
All right, I appreciate your call. Here is Todd on News Talk 1010.
Good morning, Gary. I've sold a couple private, but more often with an agent. And what my agent has told me, and I believe, is that in a private deal, somebody gets ripped off. It's either, you know, you don't get enough, you could have got more, or the person buying pays too much. I believe both sides need an agent to make sure it's a fair deal.
Okay, so you said you've sold a number of times. Would you sell in this hot market without an agent?
I would not do that. I would not buy without an agent either.
Okay. You know, I've never done it without an agent either, and I've bought and sold quite a number of houses, and I think I would want that professional expertise. But, you know, I understand that some people don't, and they will sell their house, Todd.
Well, they will. And the couple that I've done privately, the agent that I use, he's a friend of mine. He was in my wedding party, so he still gives me some guidance, mm-hmm. you could say, which without his guidance, I don't think I would do it.
All right.
But both private deals, they had, you know, some extenuating circumstances, the reason that I went private rather than going through him professional.
All right, Todd, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
We'll continue with your calls. 872-1010 is the number. It's an interesting issue that our news department has put on the table, so I want to follow up on it. Somebody just wrote in about the guy on Kijiji. Why didn't he use eBay and get the auction advantage? You know, that's actually an excellent question.
There's a brand new way to listen to your favorite radio station. The iHeartRadio app for your mobile and tablet. Download it for free today and enjoy your favorite radio station anytime, anywhere. You're listening to Jerry Agar, News Talk 1010.
Our news department put together a series of reports. They debuted this morning. They'll be continuing, but they started with the story of a guy who sold his home on Kijiji in 15 minutes. His name is Joe.
you give me 980, 50 grand cash, no conditions, and we got a done deal. And he said, okay. So literally from the time I listed it on Kijiji to the time I sold it was about 15 minutes.
All right. So talking about whether or not you would use an agent, whether you believe in fact that the agent will get you more, I believe, than in a market like this. In fact, you have no idea what your home is worth. Nobody actually knows what your home is worth. It's amazing what people will offer if they are aware your home is for sale. If Joe sold his home in 15 minutes on Kijiji, how many people knew his home was for sale before he had already signed a deal with somebody? What about the guy who might have given him another 100 grand, another 200 grand? That happens in this market all the time. That person never had a chance to buy the house. Frank Leo wrote to me, Frank Leo of Remax West, I can't tell you the amount of times we had immediate offers on a property and the buyer always said, that's the best offer. And when the offer date came, there were other offers and even the same buyers came back with more money and they didn't even get the property. Which tells you that, yes, if you sell to the first person that views your home, you can very easily leave money on the table. Somebody wrote to me by text message, don't you get a degree of financial security if you use an agent? Less chance to get scammed by buyer or seller. I don't know about that. I think the answer to that would be you should at least have a lawyer, shouldn't you? Now, that's a fee. That's not a percentage. And so working with a lawyer to make sure all the paperwork is legitimate on both sides of the equation and that you have the money in the bank and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, I would recommend, unless you're some sort of expert yourself, I believe it would be foolish not to do that. Here is Lloyd on News Talk 1010.
The reason that the process, a lot of people choose to use a realtor is because they make it so difficult to get real-time statistics. Unlike in the States where you've got Zillow, where you know the exact comparables, what it's selling for, here they make it very difficult to get that real-time information. That's why you almost need a realtor, because they've made the system so convoluted and lacking in transparency that they're the only ones that can navigate it.
Okay, but do you not think there's legitimacy to what I'm saying, that if you have the maximum number of people vying for your home, you have a better chance than if you just sell to the first person who comes along?
Well, because they make it so difficult to know what the comparable homes are selling for.
No, wait a minute. This guy did that to himself. He put it on Kijiji. A guy said, I'll give you this. Well, I want this. Okay, bang, bang, bang. 15 minutes, done deal. It's hard for me to believe he got the most he could get.
Well, but at least he saved at least $50,000 in real estate fees, number one.
But he might have got $300,000 more for his home. This is the GTA, for Pete's sake.
But the thing is, with MLS and the systems that they have, it's very difficult to find out what the comparables go for. They're the ones that hold on to those statistics. And it's done a good job in scaring the people that the only right way to buy a home is with a real estate agent. And if you know what they cost, like with a website like Zillow in the States, where you know the real-time stats, it's very, very easy.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying there. But I also think that Joe could have probably been a little more aggressive himself and said, I don't have to sell it in 15 minutes. I could sell it in 15 days and see what happens, you know, or a week. I think he'd have done better. Thanks very much for your call. I appreciate it. Here is Debbie.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. We had our cottage on Lake Simcoe for sale with an agent for 3 months.
Uh-huh.
We got one showing. The listing ran out. I said to my husband, let's just put it on Kijiji to see what happens. We put it on Sunday. Deal done. Lawyered. Done. Friday.
Okay. Well, I would say two things with that. I'm glad that you're happy with it. You had a lousy agent, didn't you?
I would say he was lousy. Yes.
So that's another factor. Debbie, thanks for your call.
Yes.
I appreciate it. Here is Paul.
Hey, Jerry.
Hi.
Sounds like you're almost running an infomercial here. But anyways, my point, can you explain to me, and maybe you can have all your real estate agent friends phone in and tell me, what do they do differently for a $500,000 house that they do for $1 million house that deserves them doubling the amount of money they make?
Well, you see, if I thought that I was selling a house for a very high value, I might say to the agent, I want to negotiate with you here on how much your commission would be, let's say, on the first half a million or on the second half million. I mean, everything's negotiable, it seems to me.
Well, that's true. I can tell you I've sold several properties and houses on a competing, like a Comfrey type of company, and I've had no problems. And you know what? You can get all the information you want from real estate agents. You can have them come in, and they'll tell you what you should ask for your house, et cetera, and what it should finally sell for. You don't need to spend $50,000 or $100,000 of your money to find out what they think. And frankly, you know, the Toronto real estate market boggles my mind that people will buy a house unseen and no conditions and make the biggest purchase of their life. That guy, he just sold a house for $1 million to a guy who doesn't even have one clue about what it's about. And the real estate agents are the ones that are fueling this because of this whole underlisting. And that seems to be a pretty unethical thing for me to be. But you know what? If people are willing to play that game, I guess that's fine.
Nobody, Paul, you're
knowingly,
Paul,
do that.
You're accusing the wrong people. There's only one group of people that fuels the prices that we have today. And it's not the agent, and it's not the seller. It's the buyer.
Anyway, my last point, Jerry.
No, wait a minute. Don't blow that off. It is the buyer, Paul. When the buyers stop paying this kind of price, prices will come down.
Okay, so here's one thing for people who are listening. If they want to read a very interesting thing about real estate agents and who they're really working for, get the book Freakonomics.
Yep. Good book.
And have them read the chapter about real estate agents. It's not very long, but it tells you exactly who they are working for when you have them in the middle of a transaction.
They're working for the same person that you and I work for, Paul.
They're working for themselves.
Yeah, that's who you and I work for, Paul. That's how it works. Here's Byron on News Talk 1010.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to just say before I start my comment, I'm a mortgage agent.
Okay.
And I do think realtors are still important, especially just for the legal aspect.
Well, what about just having a lawyer?
Yeah, that can work. But just some of the different clauses and just kind of the cover your butt factor. I hope the guy from Kijiji did, you know, get legal advice on stuff like that because it can go bad.
Byron, thanks for your call.
No problem.
There's a lot of conversation these days about hits to the head, whether it's little kids playing sports or just participating in sort of the rough and tumble world of being a little kid to some degree, all the way up to professional athletes who, let's face it, generate a lot of power when they collide with one another. There have been tragic cases of people who have lost their mind, so to speak, because they've just been hit so many times in the head. So it's kind of surprising to hear about this study. Toronto researchers came out with a study from the Rotman Research Institute at Toronto's Baycrest Health Sciences Center on brain images and genetic data, conducting a battery of tests on retired NHL players. And what they say is they did not find the level of damage they expected. Doesn't matter how many concussions they had during their careers or whether they have the kinds of things they would be looking for scientifically, type of gene that has been associated with increased dementia. If there was impairment, it was subtle, and nobody was significantly cognitively impaired, is what they say from their study. That's surprising. No one, I guess, is more surprised than some of the former NHL players who said, well, that's not how we feel. So to fill us in on this, neurosurgeon, spine surgeon, and chairman of Concussion, Dr. Li-Lang Cha, good morning.
Good morning, Jerry. How are you?
I'm doing well. Are you surprised by what these researchers are saying?
Well, Jerry, we need to be careful when we interpret the data, and we need to be cautious about making generalizations when we're looking at a small number of athletes. That being said, even in this particular study, on one measure of cognitive function, executive function, there was a decline in function amongst the alumni athlete group. Also, you know, from previous articles, there was a 59% reported rate of psychiatric conditions amongst the alumni athlete group. I also think we need to be careful with those high numbers as well. You know, I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. However, that being said, we do know that having more concussions is not a good thing, even from this particular study.
Okay. I guess I find it surprising because maybe we've had so much conversation. Are we tipping the public perception and even the perception of ex-athletes too far in another direction, saying, you know, before they used to just say, I got my bell rung, but I feel fine. Now maybe we're going too far the other way in public perception.
Yeah, I think you make a great point. I mean, you know, asking the commissioner of the NHL about concussions is like asking a far-right Republican about climate change, okay? So you're on one extreme.
Or a far-left politician about economics. But anyway, keep going.
No, absolutely agree. I mean, even asking a far-left about climate change as well, because in that case, they'll say, you know, absolutely, completely alternative energy. You're right.
Yeah.
I think your point's well taken, that you don't want to be on either extreme of the spectrum. And I think that's the real issue here as well with concussions, like you've mentioned, that this study is telling us, and I think what we can take away from this study is that in general, playing professional sports doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a decline in brain function. And I think that's important for the kids out there, that playing sports is a good thing, and overall, that risk may not be very high. That being said, we need to ensure that athletes sit out when in doubt. I'll give you an example from yesterday's game with the Leafs. Towards the end of the game, just before overtime, Anderson took a hit from one of his own players and went down.
Yep.
And the commentary, if you listen carefully to what the commentator said, is they said, it's good that Anderson didn't show any signs of a concussion and was able to avoid showing those signs because the concussion protocol might have kicked in and he might have been removed from the game.
I noticed that myself, Doctor. I'm glad you brought it up because, in fact, what the commentators were saying is he's playing so well, we'd hate to have him come out of the game even if he has suffered a head injury.
Right. And I think, you know, we can't speculate on what they meant, but I agree with you. I took it the same way. I think what, you know, might be the right message to send to kids was that it's good that despite the fact that he took that hit, that he didn't display any signs of a concussion, and we were able to have our netminder stay in the game. As opposed to sending a message to the kids out there that, you know what, if you're in an important game and, you know, this is, you know, staying in the playoffs or getting eliminated, make sure that if you have a concussion, you don't show signs of having that concussion. And we don't want to send that message because we do know that repetitive concussions are not good. It's better to sit out when in doubt. And I think this study is very valuable. It's very early on. It's a small amount of data, but it tells us that, you know what, in general, sports potentially are safe. We do know that multiple concussions are not good, but I think we have to be careful with that messaging. And I really, Jerry, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think if we go too far to the right or too far to the left, you know, in any instance, maybe we're really not getting the right message out there.
Dr. Leland Jai is with me, neurosurgeon, spine surgeon, chairman of concussion on this new study, and it was done at the Rotman Research Institute at Baycrest Health Sciences in Toronto, and they found fewer problems with concussions from NHL players, former NHL players, that they studied. I think one of the things that comes to mind all the time for me, doctor, is Sandy Annunziata is a regular commentator here on my show. He played in the CFL for many years, and he's admitted on the air that he worries. He's not panicked, but he worries, will I develop some problem in the future? And he doesn't know because it doesn't matter how many times he got hit. Someone could be hit fewer times than him and have severe problems. Another person could be hit more than him and have no problems, and we don't know why that is.
Yeah, you know, Jerry, to comment on that, you know, the example I would give and what we're beginning to discuss in our scientific and research circles is that it potentially could be similar to cigarette smoking in the sense that all of us know people who've smoked a pack a day all their lives and have never had lung cancer. We also know people who smoked very little and have also developed lung cancer. And we know people who haven't smoked at all and have developed lung cancer. However, in general, we would agree as a society and with the science that the more you smoke in general, the higher your likelihood is to develop lung cancer. And I think it's similar what we're seeing and what we will continue to see in the future with concussion data, that there will be some people that for genetic reasons and other reasons may not be affected by multiple concussions. There may be some people, like you correctly mentioned, who could have one concussion and could have severe symptoms. But in general, it's not a good idea to be subjected to multiple concussions. And I think if we keep sports safe for the kids, you know, you've had a personal experience with this as well that you spoke about on the air as well,
yeah,
with your family. I'm sure you would agree that if we keep sports safe for kids, remove them in the event of a suspected concussion, only return them when we're sure, continue to improve the research that we can better diagnose this condition, develop treatments to help people, just like your colleague that you spoke about, that is there any treatment we could provide him that would mitigate his risk in the future of developing symptoms? I think as a society, if we work in all those directions, not be too extreme to the left or the right, you know, work progressively as a group. I think if we brought reasonable league commissioners, reasonable owners, reasonable former and current players, and really worked on solutions to move this ahead, I think that would be the best path forward. And, you know, I think you'd agree, even if we look at politics, I know, you know, you're very well versed in this. Sometimes you would think that if you formed a coalition between people just off the right, just off the left, and moved ahead, you could really pass some good legislation.
Yeah, that's why we like minority governments. Dr. Nilang Jha has been with me, neurosurgeon, spine surgeon, chairman of Concussion with a K. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow between 9 and noon on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.